Medlock against Indiana University is next up for argument. Mr. Frazier.
Good morning, gentlemen. What we are not here about today is to challenge the reasonableness of a health and safety inspection performed by a university. What we are here to challenge today is an overreaching health and safety inspection.
Mr. Frazier, we're here on an appeal from the denial of a preliminary injunction dealing with the suspension of your client for 1 year, right?
Yes, sir.
And the suspension occurred in March 2011, right?
Yes, sir.
So it ends next month.
Correct.
If the suspension were ended today, could your client begin the current semester at Indiana University?
No.
No, it's too late, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, it therefore looks, does it not, like this appeal is moot? If we affirm, your client can't go back to this semester. If we reverse, your client can't go back to this semester. Therefore, nothing turns on this appeal. That's what makes a case or a part of a case moot. I mean, what turns on this appeal if your client can't go back to school this semester, no matter what we do, and if your client will be able to go back to school next semester, no matter what we do, because his suspension will be over?
The difference is, Your Honor, is that my client will have has four Fs and one D. At the point in time that he started...
That's not a subject of preliminary injunctive relief. That can be handled later on. Your request for a preliminary injunction was to get your client back as a student. And you've just said that can't happen. It's too late for that to happen.
But we also, Your Honor, requested that his grades...
Yeah, and you want damages, too, but there's a lot of stuff that can be handled later.
Well, but he cannot go to another university without a letter in his file that says, that indicates he's a drug dealer. He can't go to another school.
Since the spring 2012 semester has begun, he can't go to some other university in spring 2012. It's just too late.
But it's not too late to change the grades. It's not too late to change the constitutional wrongs that have been done. The constitutional wrongs in and of themselves are presumptive evidence that would indicate that he should be immediately given his old grades back. He can, and have the letter taken out of his file. There's, additionally, Your Honor, the district court erred when it found that Mr. Medlock consented to the search. There was no evidence of a signed contract in the record at all.
I have one other question about
Sir.
What we need to reach, even if this is not moot. Do we need to consider anything more than whether the exclusionary rule applies in student suspension proceedings?
Well, I think it clearly does apply in student suspension.
Now, how is that compatible with INS against Lopez Mendoza?
That's compatible, Your Honor, because in this type of a situation, we have state actors going into university students' rooms.
Would you reconcile your position with Lopez Mendoza? Don't just restate the facts of this case.
I can't do that, Your Honor.
No, I suspect you can't do that. Your brief doesn't talk about it. The Supreme Court held in Lopez Mendoza that the exclusionary rule never applies in civil proceedings. This is a civil proceeding, QED.
But we've cited several civil proceedings in our briefs in which the exclusionary rule does apply.
Counsel, Lopez Mendoza was decided in 1984. You have cited no case more recent than the 70s. It's completely understandable why you've cited no case more recent than the 70s. It's because the Supreme Court rejected them in 1984.
Your Honor, what we think is applicable here would be this Court's decision in City of Platteville. In City of Platteville...
And what year was that decided?
I believe 99, Your Honor. And in City of Platteville, the Court looked at a regulatory scheme by the City of Platteville in which there were regulatory inspections.
I now remember that case. Your brief has some difficulty telling the difference between the Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule. The Fourth Amendment plainly applies to civil inspections and all civil matters. But to say the Fourth Amendment applies to X does not mean that the exclusionary rule applies to X. That's the point of cases like Lopez-Mendoza. So when you rely on cases for the proposition the Fourth Amendment applies, you might have the basis for an action in damages. That's what remains in the district court. But you don't have the basis for the exclusionary rule, which is what you need to get the suspension set aside or the grades changed or anything like that. That's why I was asking about Lopez-Mendoza, which is about the exclusionary rule.
But doesn't the fact that the Indiana University Police acted in concert with the residents' leadership supervisors clearly indicate that the Constitution has been invited or violated when the residents' supervisors are exceeding the scope of their bounds?
Counsel, only state actors can violate the Fourth Amendment, right? There's no doubt that the Fourth Amendment applies. Indiana University is a state institution. But the reason why Lopez-Mendoza is called the Immigration and Naturalization Service against Lopez-Mendoza is that public officials violated the Fourth Amendment. That's the assumption of Lopez-Mendoza, and the court then holds, but the exclusionary rule doesn't apply to civil proceedings. So Lopez-Mendoza was deported. He had an action of damages, potentially, but he was deported. Your client has an action in damages, potentially, but doesn't yet, can't upset the result of the suspension proceeding.
Your Honor, relating to the procedural due process claim, he was not given a pre-deprivation hearing. There was no evidence that was...
He was given three hearings.
But he wasn't given a pre-deprivation hearing. He was, there was no evidence.
Ms. Lopez holds the pre-deprivation in an educational setting. All that's required is an opportunity to talk to the decision maker. Did he not have that?
Not pre-deprivation, no. It was a summary suspension.
He didn't have the opportunity to talk to the dean? I mean, your adversary says he did.
Not pre-suspension, no.
Before the one-year suspension was entered, he did not have any opportunity to talk to anybody.
Correct. Dean Goldsmith entered that one-year suspension before he got to do anything. It was about 23 days later, I believe. The summary suspension was entered on March 11th. He requested a hearing on March 15th. On March 28th, he got his first hearing.
I'm just not clear. What Goss says is required is just an opportunity to talk to the decision-maker, not a hearing. So the question I had asked you was, did he have an opportunity to talk to the dean of students?
No.
No opportunity. Okay. I think the university is telling us the opposite.
And Goss also says that longer suspensions or expulsions, such as we have here, may require more formal procedures. And also what's important, Your Honor, is in the case of this district circuit's case of Lamb, there's a discussion relating to whether there's mitigating factors can be presented. At no time in the process until my client was met with Provost Hansen in early May when the semester was over, did he have a chance to be able to put forth mitigative issues. And the importance of that is, Your Honor, when he goes into the summary suspension, what happens is that all bets are off. You cannot discuss mitigative circumstances. But in contrast, if he would have been put into the other side, the judicial hearing side of this, he would have then had the opportunity to be able to put forward mitigating circumstances. In addition, Your Honor, we think that his rights were violated because Dean Goldsmith was acting as Provost Hanson's designee. While he was acting as Provost Hanson's designee, Provost Hanson then affirmed that. It's a due process prohibits a governmental decision maker from reviewing his own decision. Your Honor, and if you look at the rules, it really clearly points out that if the student believes that summary suspension is inappropriate, it's at page 293B1, that's where they can, it says or indicates there's going to be some type of an ability to put together some type of a mitigative argument. But then if you go down to at page 293 of the appendix B8, if the commission finds the school has committed the offense, it shall uphold the summary suspension. So at the first level of the appeal, because there were two appeal levels, there was no discretion either way as to whether or not the summary suspension could be changed. And so by the point that he gets to meet with Provost Hanson in early May, the semester was over. Your Honor, I would save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Unless there are other questions, sir.
I don't see any. Mr. Clairman.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Zachary Medlock was suspended from Indiana University for 1 year because he possessed 90 grams of marijuana, a large quantity of drug paraphernalia.
I'd like you to begin with where I began with Mr. Frazier. Is this appeal moot?
As to the suspension, I think it's a reasonable conclusion of this Court that the appeal is mooted.
What is there here other than the suspension?
Other than the suspension, they moved for a preliminary injunction based on wanting grades changed and wanting his disciplinary record expunged. I agree with the Court's...
That doesn't sound like an appropriate step for a preliminary injunction. Expungement is a permanent remedy at the end of the case.
I would agree, and I think the district court found that there was no showing of irreparable harm. I would file the grades and the expungement under that.
Forget irreparable harm. I'm trying to ask about mootness.
Yes.
Is there anything live, right? What Mr. Frazier said is live is the dispute about what grades are on the record. And that, as I say, that sounds like a question about remedies at the end of the case rather than preliminary relief. Is there anything that's live that's an appropriate subject of preliminary relief?
The appellees say that there is nothing live that is an appropriate subject of preliminary relief. Now, I guess you could fashion an argument where he wants to go get a job, and there are grades on his transcript today, four Fs and a D from the spring 2011 semester, and ostensibly he is asked preliminarily an emergent motion with the district court to have those grades changed now. I submit that there is no irreparable harm stated by that alleged injury, and therefore it is injunctive relief, but not of consequence that it should be addressed preliminarily. I'm not sure that it's quite moot, and that's why we didn't argue that it was moot. But it certainly doesn't rise to the level of irreparable harm.
Actually, a subject of concern. Mootness is a limitation on the subject matter jurisdiction of the federal courts, and lawyers are supposed to address jurisdictional issues before they get to the merits, and neither side did.
Understood, and that is why we didn't, Your Honor, because we felt that there was preliminary injunctive remedies sought that weren't mooted by the passage of time. The only one that is ostensibly mooted by the passage of time is the one that the court pointed out, and that is the suspension in the beginning of the semesters. The record below is that Mr. Medlock is eligible to reapply or apply for reinstatement after March 11, 2012. At that time, Dean Goldsmith will consider his application for reinstatement, and he would be eligible to begin at the first summer session, 2012. But because of the other requests for relief that we thought were better placed in the subject heading of irreparable harm as opposed to mootness, that's why the appellees did not brief the mootness issue. The claims, the district court found that Mr. Medlock could not carry his burden of establishing reasonable likelihood of success on the merits, and did not establish his burden of persuading the court that he would be irreparably harmed. We ask the court to affirm the district court. As to the merits argument, the Fourth Amendment applies to Indiana as a state university. The line that we would ask the court to look at is institutional health and safe, legitimate institutional purpose inspections versus criminal probable cause searches. Both are present in this case, but the only one that's really at issue in this case is the legitimate institutional health and safety inspection. The record is that two residential life specialists, these are people who are employed to keep order in university residence halls, were conducting a building search before spring break of 2011. They went room to room to make sure that there were no code violations. When they entered Mr. Medlock's room, they observed in plain view marijuana on his desk. They, as they are trained to do, they contacted the police, told the police what they saw, showed the police the marijuana in plain view, and the police began its investigation. Now, I set the police investigation aside because he was charged criminally, and the issue of exclusion or not is one, we believe, for the criminal court. There is no authority for exclusionary rules in school discipline proceedings. They've cited some cases for quasi-criminal proceedings. We don't think that any of those are squarely on point with school.
Why in the world didn't you cite Lopez-Mendoza, or for that matter, Pennsylvania Board of Probation against Scott? There are two controlling Supreme Court decisions, and instead the parties are citing decisions of the District of New Hampshire in 1975. Isn't that a little odd?
That's our error, Your Honor. The civil proceeding nature, this is an administrative proceeding. I don't know that it's a civil proceeding. It wasn't in court.
It's not criminal, therefore it's civil.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't think that there's a basis to exclude evidence, and if the court were inclined to find one in a school disciplinary administrative proceeding, we don't think that this is an appropriate case to do that, because Mr. Medlock had an opportunity, had a procedure available to him, and never alleged that the evidence was improperly obtained. The university procedures provide a mechanism by which a student who believes that evidence has been improperly obtained, either under the law or under school regulations, can raise that issue by filing it with the Dean of Students' Office. He never did that in this case. As to the constitutional due process argument, we think that there was ample process given in this case. He had two levels of review, a level of review with a panel, where the panel was charged with determining whether or not Mr. Medlock was responsible for the conduct alleged by Dean Goldsmith. Dean Goldsmith alleged that Mr. Medlock's conduct was a threat to the campus community. The panel agreed and therefore upheld the summary suspension. He then had a second level of review with the provost. The provost had the ability to consider all evidence, all arguments in mitigation, to commute the sentence, to reverse Dean Goldsmith. She testified that there were no limitations on the remedy that she could craft in her position as provost. She met with Mr. Medlock in person. There are written submissions that Mr. Medlock provided. Again, never raising the issue of exclusion. Ample due process was afforded to Mr. Medlock in this case. To respond to an issue that the court raised with Mr. Frazier, it is true that the initial suspension handed out by Dean Goldsmith on March 11, Mr. Dean Goldsmith initiated a summary suspension procedure. So he was, in effect, suspended on March 11, 2011. And that is before the first panel had a hearing.
The question I was asking, and maybe I wasn't clear, did the student have an opportunity to meet with the dean? It was not a question about was there a formal hearing before the dean. A question about meeting, about whether there was ever any kind of exchange. That was the question.
Thank you. I understand. No. The letter was issued based on Dean Goldsmith's review of the residential life specialist incident report, which reported the amount of drugs, reported the amount of paraphernalia, and reported the existence of an active marijuana grow operation in the dormitory room. Based on those factors alone, Dean Goldsmith was of the opinion that his continued presence constituted a threat to the campus community and therefore summarily suspended him. And then after that proceeding is initiated, then first meeting, if you will, is the campus panel hearing, followed by the meeting with the provost.
What was the date of that hearing?
March 27th. March 28th, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
The appellees ask that the court affirm the denial of preliminary injunctive relief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against